Today, Guy Standings, 8 Giants, and the potential for UBI. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of those posts covering finance and property news. At the moment, we have some work going on in the studio with the power systems being upgraded and also the fibre connections are replaced as well. So we're off air real time. However, there are more than 5,000 shows in the DFA archive, and I guess that many of you won't necessarily have caught up with some of the really good ones. So what I'm doing is I'm going to replay some classic episodes over the next few days that really get to the heart of some of the critical issues that have driven my thinking over the last few years. So in this show, I talked to Guy Standing, who is a research associate in London, and discussed specifically the question of UBI in the context of that we are rich countries, yet 6% of households in poverty have people in jobs, and inequality is the highest it's been for 100 years. So there is a really important question here. What is the solution? Well, Guy suggests that basic income is something we should consider. And actually, this is not a new idea. So this is a really important show. And in the light of what's happened since I recorded it in 2020, things have, well, got worse. So this is a very relevant conversation. And today I'm joined by Guy Standing, who's a professional research associate at SOAS University of London and a founding member and honorary co-president of the Basic Income Earth Network, a non-governmental organisation that promotes a basic income for all. Hello, Guy. Good to see you.
Very nice to be talking to you.
And I think at this time, with all the uncertainty around the world, this is a really, really important subject. But I guess a starting point for me is, you know, the universal basic income and those sorts of concepts have been around for a long time, and yet they seem to have got momentum recently. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think the global economy has been extremely fragile. It's a bubble economy that's been building up to a crisis point. The tragedy that's unfolding is a trigger to the economic collapse that we're going to be facing over the next months and maybe years, which will make the Great Depression seem very comparable. And it's that degree of crisis. Now, as it coincidentally, my latest book came out last Friday, and the title of the book is Battling 8 Giants. And the subtitle is Basic Income Now. And it took the image of these 8 giants comes from Beveridge, William Beveridge's report of 1942. And he had 5 giants. And he said that constructing the welfare state, he didn't use that particular term, but social policy revolution, he put it, was based on the need to confront those 5 giants. And the 5 giants were want, squalor, idleness, and illness, and so on. His giants were very much the giants of that age, right? And my imagery of the book is that we have 8 giants blocking our way to a good society. That's the image, right? And the 8 giants are inequality, number one. Inequality has become incredible by the standards of the past. It's much greater now. And wealth inequality is much greater than income inequality. And the share of income in Australia, or in Britain, in the United States, even in China, the share of income going to people who do work, who labor, has been going down and down and down. I mean, it's a global trend. And more of the income that is generated and the wealth in our countries has been going to the rentiers, the people who own property financial, physical, or intellectual property, so-called. And more of that income has gone to the plutocracy, to the elite, with some trickle down to those who have good salaried jobs and so on. And the first giant is inequality. The second giant that stems from that is insecurity. We have chronic insecurity. And the millions and millions of people that I've been writing about who are in the precariat, and I'll come to that in a moment, face a life of chronic insecurity. And insecurity breeds some of the other giants, or strengthens some of the other giants. Now, the third giant, and the one that really is going to be the immediate cause of the economic collapse that we're facing, is debt. We have higher debt than at any time in history. So the United States has the private debt, just private debt, household debt, comes to over 150% of GDP, 100%, 150% of national income. That means that any small downturn is going to affect people's ability to pay their debts, to service their debts. That's huge fragility in the system. The same in Britain, the highest personal debt ever. And even in the European Union countries that seem stronger than others, they have huge private debt. So that makes for a very fragile system. And on top of that, we have huge corporate debt. You know, in the United States, corporate debt comes to about 3/4 of GDP. I mean, it's the value of it is that. So there's going to be a string of bankruptcies if there's a decline. And it's particularly true now because the global economy has been based on very long supply chains. In other words, the major corporations often have 40 plants and producers and suppliers in 30 or 40 countries. And if the one link goes, then the whole sequence is going to be shattered. And it turns out that about 3/4 of the Fortune 1000 companies, the biggest companies, are going to be affected by this supply chain disruption. So it's going to be a multiplier effect of that. So the insecurities are systemic and they're personal, right? Now, the fourth giant is a different type of giant, but wherever I talk, the audience nods because they know what it is, and that's stress. We have a very stressful population now. Millions of people feel stressed out of their little minds. You know, many of us, we feel. And that stress feeds into rising rates of morbidity, rising suicidal tendencies, rising cardiac problems, and many other medical problems. So it's already contributing to a rising problem of health. And the fifth giant is one that's less easily understood by the lay person, but it's precarity. And precarity goes with the precariat that I've been writing about. People who are in their millions now, it's the largest class of people, because they have to rely on money wages. But money wages have been stagnant or falling and have been more uncertain and fluctuating. The precariat have no securities, no for access to rights-based benefits, and they feel like supplicants. They feel as if they have to be asking for favors, whether it's from an employer, a bureaucrat, a parent, family members, or whatever, you know. And this sense of precarity accentuates the insecurity, accentuates the debt, and leads to one later giant. And the next giant is the one that a lot of AI people talk about. And I've been invited to Silicon Valley, and I've been invited to Davos and talking about these things. And that's the robots. the robots are coming, right? And there's a fear out there that they're going to displace us all, make us all redundant, and we'll have no jobs, etc. I don't believe that. I believe that the automation and the AI is involving incredible disruption. But I do not believe we are suddenly going to find we've got nothing to do. I think many of us work much harder today and for longer hours than we did 20 years ago, right? And yet technologies have advanced enormously in that period, right? So if we're going to be displaced, why hasn't that happened? It's called the lump of labor fallacy. As if we have a certain amount of work to do, and therefore if machines come along and they're labor displacing, we'll suddenly have nothing to do. That profoundly misinterprets the human condition. I constantly feel I don't have enough time to do the things I want to do. I'm sure you do, and I'm sure many of your listeners have that feeling. We feel stressed. We have too many demands on our time. And most of us go through life wishing we've been able to spend more time caring for our loved ones, caring for our communities. We want to do a lot more things. And that, I think, technology is going to help us in that respect. But it's very disruptive. It's very disruptive, this technological change. And without a doubt, it's worsening inequality, because more and more of the income is going to the owners of the technology, the owners of the robots, etc. So it's a distributional problem, an income distributional problem, rather than one that's going to make us all have nothing to do. I think that's the point I want to make. But it is a giant standing in the way of a good society. We have to confront the problems that come with that. And the next giant is the one that I have argued in the book is the one that's the tipping point that I think will make the agenda for a basic income successful. And that is the threat of extinction. I don't need to tell an Australian audience today how close we are to losing the species, losing our ecology, losing our ability to live sustainably after all the fires, the droughts and the floods and the global warming and the destruction of the Great Barrier Reef and all of these things that are rushing towards us. And they're absolutely urgent, and I totally support the Extinction Rebellion. They may not do the sort of things that I would wish them to do in some respects, but the motivation and the energy is going to be desperately needed, because we've got to shake up the gerontocracy and the others who are ruling the world and say, no, you can't give it third priority, you give it first priority. And I think we're moving in that direction. And a basic income in that respect is needed, because it moves from resource-depleting labor to resource-preserving work, community work, care work, preserving the species. This sort of thing is work, but it doesn't destroy resources and use up resources. It's a different sort of lifestyle. And that lifestyle is worthy of respect. And the eighth giant is the one, when I get invited to Davos and places like that, they understand, which is the advance of neo-fascist populism. And populism is sweeping the world. We have politicians without any backbone and without any values running the world. We have some people that are unworthy of any public position, and yet they are playing on people's fears. They are offering to bring back yesterday. They are refusing to confront global warming properly. They are just looking after their own and their people around them, the plutocracy and the financial elite. And it's about time we confronted them. But at the moment, they've been on the advance. It's the rest of us who have been sitting watching in disgust, Who would have thought a man like Donald Trump would become president of the United States? A man totally ill-equipped for that role, as he's proving with his stumbling imitation of Nero in the United States with dealing with the coronavirus. So we have this hellish thought that we could, I'm not saying definitely will, but we could be moving into another era like in the 1930s, when autocratic authoritarians became governments and, you know, tear up the rule books on democracy and so on. So I think that eighth giant is one that actually, to be fair, is frightening the titans of industry, as well as people like me and you, and the precariat. The precariat understand these things. They're not yet in a position to mobilize and really confront, but it's growing. But I think that the interesting thing is that when I get invited to Silicon Valley or Los Angeles or these other places, corporate people, the sensible ones are not gung-ho right-wing libertarians. They are people who want the global market system to function well, and they recognize you need stable governments, you need governments that don't play on fear but bring people together. We haven't seen that, have we? We just have not seen it. So we have these eight giants, but of course, you and I today are sitting here surrounded by the ninth giant. The ninth giant is this, the tragedy that's unfolding, I think, is accelerating the need for a different type of politics, a different type of multilateral solidarity, a different type of income distribution system, an ability for us to recreate and strengthen our sense of community. I'm in a small village here talking to you. We're in total lockdown. We can only go out when we want to go and get bread. And everybody's in their little gardens or whatever. And I'm beginning to see sort of long distance community rebuilding, you know, little notes being sent around from the younger people in the village to the older ones, let me know if you need me to go and get, you know, the solidarity of people is re-emerging, and it's wonderful. But this is a terrifying tragedy, and we've got to give people resilience. We have to strengthen your resilience, my resilience, and everybody's resilience, because the strength of our community, the strength of the human community is going to depend on our ability to strengthen the resilience of our weakest members. The strong will always look after themselves, but if the weakest members are made weaker, then the tragedy is going to get worse, and the follow-up social illnesses and social deaths will be almost as great as the tragedy. So we've got a real crisis. And I believe a basic income is part of the solution, part of the proper response. And we can afford it. And it doesn't have those negative effects that middle-class prejudiced people say. It won't make people lazy. In fact, we all, our pilots show that people who have a basic income work more. They're more cooperative. They're more altruistic. They're more dynamic. They've got more energy and confidence. They take the sort of risks that we would like them to take. In other words, I want to experiment with this type of work. But if you're chronically insecure, you don't. Because if you make a mistake, you're out. So I think the debate we're going to see going forward around this, facilitated by people like you who've got to encourage the conversation, is actually going to be potentially a wonderful one, a liberating one. And that, I very much hope, will happen.
Well, Guy, I appreciate you. That's a wonderful overview. And I must tell you that a lot of my followers say to me they feel very disempowered at the moment, very insecure. Their wages have not grown. They've got this massive amount of debt. They're running ever faster to go round in circles, you know, in the old round the treadmill. And they're looking for an alternative. And frankly, the mainstream has no story other than more debt. You know, what's the solution at the moment? Borrow more to be able to actually get through the next few months. I mean, it's very weird. So it's really empowering to hear, if you like, an alternative narrative. Now, you mentioned the pilots, and people may not know, you know, UBI has been tested. It has been tried, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I've been very, very fortunate in that I've been working for basic income for more than 30 years since we set up Bien. And during that time, it's very rare that somebody who believes in something has an opportunity to put it into effect. I mean, you feel very privileged and humble, genuinely, that that's been the case. And I've been involved in doing pilots in Africa, pilots in India, big one in India, I'll come to it in a minute. I've been advising on the Finland pilot, which was conducted, which was not a real basic income, but it was on unemployed. In the Ontario one, there's been a very good pilot, which a new right-wing governor came in, and a prime minister of the state, of the province rather, and abolished it, but it was already being proven to be very successful. I've seen the Alaska Permanent Fund and Dividends, which is a form of basic income. North Carolina has had a very good pilot. I even participated in a pilot which was televised in the UK. A small number of families were involved in it. And we've been planning pilots in Scotland and the Netherlands and so on. So there have been a lot of pilots. And let me just say a few of the major outcomes of those pilots. What we've been doing is providing thousands of people with a basic income. That means it's not very high, but it's in cash or equivalent, paid into a bank account. It's unconditional. It's individual, so that you don't give it to a family unit or a household. You give it to each man and each woman equally, with half to a child, but paid to the mother or the surrogate mother. And it's guaranteed. In other words, it's automatic. It doesn't get taken into account in other benefits or thing. You get it as a right, right? And what we've done is, although a pilot obviously is only short term, because that's the nature, it's an experiment, right? You want it to be continued. But what we've done is you say you're going to get it for 2 years or whatever, and we're going to compare what happens to you with what happens to other similar people in other areas who will not be receiving it. So you do a comparative study. And what these pilots have shown with remarkable consistency is that the first thing you have in low income areas in particular, you have improvements in nutrition, in food, and families give priority to helping their children get better food and so on. When we did the Indian pilot, before we started, after we'd mobilized the money, we were going to provide 6,000 people with basic income. Sonia Gandhi herself asked us to her house and said, this is going to be a waste of money. They'll spend it on alcohol and tobacco, and it's a waste of money. And we said, no, we don't think so. You know, we think they will use it. It's up to them. We're not going to tell them what to do. And at the end of the pilot, 2 years later, she invited us back and she said, I wish I had known. By that time, she was about to lose the election because the results showed the families, you know, they want to improve the lives of themselves and their communities. And big deal. You'd expect that. I'd have thought so if you respect the human condition. Of course, you'll have a rotten apple or two. Of course. But the vast majority of people want to improve the lives of their families. So the nutrition of children improved, the health improved, partly because they had better nutrition, partly because they could buy shoes or whatever it might be, and afford a bus in the bad weather, etc. So the things feed on themselves. And if you have better health, then you don't have the families having to spend a lot of money on healthcare, because they've got better health, so they can spend it on other things. Then schooling attendance. And this is something both in rich countries and in poor countries where we've had pilots. The schooling attendance rates go up. That is very important. And the schooling performance rates go up. And the interesting one, we had a very long, I've described it at length in the books, a very long pilot was in North Carolina. And it was, I call it the accidental pilot, because it started by the handing out of a basic income to all the Indian families because they had a casino. And they decided that all the profits would be handed out as equal basic incomes for as long as possible. And it just by coincidentally, a study by the local university started at the same time about child development, a long-term study of child development. And what happened was that they then subsequently had the data to show what happened over 16 years of the payments. And those families that had been receiving the basic income payments had children, and those other families that didn't receive had children. And at the end of that 16 years, on average, the children of the families receiving the basic income were 1 year ahead in school. 1 year ahead. And the data had been very rich, very sophisticated data, and it showed that the main factor had been that the basic income security in those families had made for better relationships in the family and less stressful situations and a more conducive learning environment, right? Now, if I describe that to you, I presume, I hope, that this seems very eminently reasonable, and you know that's what you'd expect. You would hope, and not some scientific. Wow, it's what you would expect, right? So if that's the case, why can't the politicians try and move to that sort of system? Now, besides the schooling, we found that improvements in sanitation, improvements in work. Work increases in the communities that have basic income, and the productivity of the work. And people often going to do secondary activities as well as their primary job, doing some self-employment and do some craft work or whatever it might be. So you see improvements in work, and you see improvements in income distribution, because the basic income that's paid equally to everybody is obviously worth more for the poor person than it is for the rich. Now, you can easily have a taxation system where you tax wealth or the rental incomes that are going to the higher income groups, and therefore they don't benefit from the basic income directly. But I remember one pilot we did in Africa, and to start with, we said, everybody's entitled to this. We had what we called an awareness day, where we spoke to the community. So we said, we're going to give you this basic income, no constraints on how you use it. We're not going to interfere. Please do what you think you want to do. And there was an extremely wealthy farmer. He came down, and he came in his 4x4, and he stood at the edge and listened. And then he said to me, look, why are you paying me? I don't need this income. I don't need a basic income, right? I don't need it. So I said, well, you're a member of the community, right? You're a member of this community. He said, yeah, but I don't need it. I said, you are a member of the community, therefore you have the right as well as any of these, right? So he went away, and to his credit, he came back a couple of days later, and he said, okay, I'll participate. So he got his small amount of money, he looked at it, and he went away. That man subsequently became a complete convert, a complete advocate. He was going to the capital city and giving talks to the business community saying, this is what we want. And he said, the reason I'm in favor of it is it strengthens the community solidarity, and makes us feel better as a community. I know I'm a member of this community. I can use that money in any way, okay? But I'm watching my community benefiting. And that was great. And it reminded me to follow that up because we were doing a planning meeting in Dunfermline in Scotland, right? And I was talking about this to the our committee, cross-party group. There was a Conservative councillor, Labour councillor, Greens, SNP councillors. And then the chief of police came in to the meeting in the town hall. I thought, what's the chief of police doing here? You know, what's he doing? He came in with his full uniform, with his medals and that stuff. I thought, what's he doing? So he came in, sat down, and then when his time came, he stood up, took his hat off and put it down, and he said, I've come here because I want to say, I've thought a lot about this, and I am fully supportive, and I want to tell you that my officers are fully supportive, and I'll tell you what. And he said, we believe that if everybody in this community has basic income security, crime will go down. Crime will go down. We'll see much less petty crime. And that's why I support it. And we all just sort of, you know, we applauded him. And he's absolutely right. Because if you gave people solidarity and security, people behave better. They behave better. We're all human beings. Again, there's always rotten apples, but fundamentally, we want a sense of community. We want our neighbours. Aussies are great on that. They like their mates, right? Mm. But some of them are a bit gung-ho because they think there's a macho element. But I think that particularly the younger Aussies have got this sense of community, and they know the precariat, and they know the insecurities they face, and they would like a good community where you can compete in your sport, you can compete in your match, but you know you're all secure. And that, I think, is a mood of today.
Mm. Guy, it's very interesting there, because it seems to me that if you think about the relationship of an individual to society at the moment, in particular, you know, it's almost like, you know, kid to adult or adult to kid. You know, they almost behave like, you know, do this, do that, do that. You know, you've got to go to work, you've got to do this. What you're talking about, it seems to me, is an adult to adult relationship. Is that a fair way of summarizing it?
Yeah. I think human to human, in the sense that I, when listening to you then, reminded me of an aphorism that Picasso said. He said, every child is an artist. The challenge is to enable him to be an artist when he grows up. And in a sense, we all have a little childishness in us. And we cherish that if we've got common sense. The playfulness, the interaction, the sense of wanting to learn and you know, that part is part adult, part child. But I extend your point to the following. The ancient Greeks divided time into labor, work, recreation, and schole, or schole, okay? And schole was a combination of leisure and public participation. And the Greeks were expected to participate in their community. We can't today because we're all in shutdown, but participate in the sense of deliberative thinking, discussing, arguing, doing, but we've actually had in our societies a squeezing of schole, a squeezing that, yeah, we can watch our footy, we can go beer drinking, we can do this, but that's recreation, but we're working hard, we're laboring hard, the life is intense. So what we've lost is that ability for deliberation, for conversations about deep subjects, a learning in action. And it's reflected in our politics. It's reflected in the fact that politicians use shorter and shorter sound bites to get their vote. And they play on charisma and play on stupid slogans, right? And we are being dumbed down. We're being dumbed down. And that dumbing down is something that we all recognize, or, you know, the people who've had education recognize in particular, but we can't do much about it individually, okay? And the challenge, I think, is to create better systems in which we can spend more time in scholarly. We can spend more time looking, creating bad poetry, bad art, but, you know, creating and deliberating about the big things of the day so that we're more knowledgeable about it and therefore more resilient against the demagogues and the Trumps and the rest of it. I find it incredibly sad that 53% of American white women voted for Trump. Of course, far fewer Afro-Americans did, but 53% voted for this man who boasts about groping women and you know, is an obscene character. How come that happens? Well, it happens because people are diseducated. They don't have enough time or the resources to pursue an emancipatory, value-driven education. And I think we've lost that balance, and it's the neoliberal economic model which says education is for jobs. You go to school and university, you get jobs. I was a professor at Monash University in Melbourne, and it was one of the most sad experiences to see vast classes going through job preparation courses for exams to pass, to get the credentials. And that was nobody's fault. The professors and the lecturers and the rest of it felt inadequate. They felt that they were, it was a factory. It was a schooling factory. And it's not particularly Australian, it's everywhere. I get invited to a lot of universities and I hear the same stories, whether it's in the United States or India or Australia or New Zealand or wherever. And this sense of we're not giving ourselves education. Education is something that's liberating, and it's something that you go through and it nurtures your values, your empathy, your compassion. And for me, this is a precariat agenda. We need the basic income security. We need the commons back. I've just written a book on the commons, the plunder of the commons, and at which I gave in talk on in Brisbane last year. And the commons is something that we understand. We need to recover the commons. Mm. The common spaces, the common resources, the common air, the common water, the amenities that our predecessors have created for us. And if you privatize those and destroy those, you destroy the fabric of society and weaken the resilience that I keep talking about. So for me, this is an agenda that is not, you know, one golf club, but a whole set of golf clubs, because you can't win this good society just with one golf club. And I think that we are in a very, very interesting phase where, unless the people like you who are responsible for getting people thinking, unless we have a lot of that, we could see this disinformation, this fake news, this manipulation by intellectual thugs take over. And I, you know, on a certain day I will be pessimistic. You'll hear the latest things and the rest of it. But ultimately I believe that the young educated are angry, and they have every reason to be angry. They are also looking for better solutions. They're not going to go back. They're not going to be voting for the Trumps or the Morrisons or the Boris Johnsons or things. They'll be looking for better, a okay, a good society. And I think this is all coming together. And this tragedy, once if we can get through it without losing too many lives and ruining too many communities, which of course is quite possible, then I think it will be a transformative moment. It's like a war. When you come out of the war, when you come out of it, then there is suddenly a surge of demands. No, we're not going back to that past. We're not. And I think that's where we are today. And it means that all of us, you, me, and anybody listening, have a responsibility to ourselves and to our societies, be it Australia or anywhere, to do our bit. To do our bit. And that's the key message I give when I give talks. And I think a lot of people are doing that. I really feel it. And you know, all power to them. All power to them.
Yeah, I think you're right. There is a tipping point in my sense, you know, and there are a lot of people saying we can't go back and do the same thing again. And just to give you a very clear example, you know, it's interesting how welfare is typified in Australia as being a bad thing. You know, we have to do it because, yeah, you know, we want to give them a job, right? It's seen as, you know, very poor in terms of, you know, position in society. Whereas, of course, this is tilting it around completely and saying, whoever you are, this is available to you, right? And so it changes the game. But the political class in Australia and around the world don't want a bar of it. And I guess it's partly because it breaks the fundamental philosophical framework that they have been working within. And that's the confrontational part of this, isn't it? Because there is a confrontation here about a set of values. And, you know, what are the critical values that are going to actually determine the future of where we take society? And I guess the other point to make is that it changes also the definition of what a good job is. Because at the moment, very often it's the bankers and it's the, you know, the well-paid solicitors who are, you know, at the top of the heap. And if you think about what's happening with the current health issues, it's not those guys who can solve this. It's actually the nurse on the front line. So there's a whole set of pivoting going on in my mind.
Yeah, I think so. And I think we're beginning to learn the values of what the ecologists or greens call degrowth. I think we need to rethink what sort of growth we want. And from my mind, whether we get the terminology right, I'm not sure yet, but the idea of degrowth is to slow down, to smell the roses, to spend more time with our families and communities, focus on preserving and reproducing the beauties of the world, and turning the definition of growth. Now, for example, in Australia and in Britain and most countries, if I take care of your children, for example, and you pay me, it's called work. If you look after your own children and you spend more time looking after your own children, it's called not work, right? Well, that is as dumb as you can get. It's also sexist because actually women do most of that work still. In every society. And what it means is that we give no value to the work that most of us would regard as the most rewarding, emotionally rewarding work. And therefore, that doesn't get factored into our national income statistics or our idea of growth, which is dumb as you can get, in my view. But that's precisely what governments do. And we need to demand that they regard the work of caring, the work of volunteering, the work of looking after the woodlands or whatever it might be as work, just as much as pouring a tea for the boss in an office. Why pouring a tea for a boss should be called work and valued as added to the national income, whereas pouring tea for your children or your elderly mother is not, is just a modern idiocy. And it is an idiocy. And more of us have to have the courage to say that, in the sense that the statisticians who, if I confront them with that, they'll say, yeah, that's true, but what can I do about it? But we need to demand that things like that change. Now, they're little things, right? They're little things. But if you do that, then you're going to be having a different picture, a different narrative. You began with the story, okay? A narrative of what we're doing in our societies. Mm. And then you'll get a lot of changes, not only the images, but changes in the policy thinking. You know, how do I make it possible that you or me can spend more time looking after our elderly mother, for example, all right, without penalizing yourself to a high degree, which is often the case. And we need to think out of that. Think out of the box, you see. And I think the Greens and green in the small green sense, the people who are really concerned about the ecology and the sustainability of our society, I think they're asking the best questions. We now have to find in a society the best answers. And I think a basic income is part of that. It is part of that. And I constantly say that, and I've argued this in my books, that you know, it isn't a panacea. It's not a panacea. It's only part of a reorientation of what sort of society we want for the 21st century. And I think this tragedy is going to accelerate that shift in thinking. And, you know, we look for silver linings and all that. Mm. We've just got to get through it. And I think a basic income as an emergency measure today is absolutely vital because of the thing I said at the beginning. Our number one priority, it must be to give people resilience. Resilience. I don't care what they call this basic income. They may call it something else, Aussie grant, an Aussie grant, you know. I don't care. That's as long as the principle is enshrined that we need to strengthen the weakest people in our society as much as everybody else. Mm. And that's the key message I want to get across.
No, very good. And it's interesting, of course, if you do the math and you think about how much has been thrown at the economy in the last month or so, right? A universal basic income would be a very small quantum, right?
Yep. Of course. I mean, when people say you can't afford it, well, just watch how many billion Aussie dollars get thrown into the money system. And where did it come from? So don't tell me you can't afford to give people a small, modest income on which will enable them to pay for their food and their rent and feel secure, feel that they're going to get it next month and the month after and the month after. That's the vital part.
Yep.
I mean, it's just idiocy. And lack of imagination by ruling elites who are bloody rich themselves, and they, you know, they don't empathize with the fact that millions of Aussies and Brits and others are on their uppers. They're really on the edge, and many of them have gone over the edge, and we know that. So we've got no excuse. We've got no excuse. And when privilege just looks after its own, then you get very angry indeed. You get very angry indeed.
Yeah, and I spoke to Michael Hudson last week, and he made the point that every time you bail out the big banks and everything and the big corporations, you're tilting it away from, you know, the rest of society, and in fact society gets a smaller and smaller share of the whole action,
sure.
Right? So UBI is turning the thing back the other way and actually putting the center of gravity where it should be, which is essentially it's about the people, it's about the community, and it's about what we do there. It's actually not about the financial system and financial stability. It's something much more real.
No, I 100% agree with what you've just said, but I would like to add one thing. I don't know if Michael made this point, but each time we have a crisis, they've resorted to strengthening the financial markets.
Yep.
So each time they've grossly inflated the size of the financial sector. But that is merely storing up an even worse economic crisis the next time. It's like blowing up a bubble. It's literally you blow the bubble, and each time they've put more air into the bubble and it gets bigger and bigger. okay? So each time the bubble explodes, it's bigger than it was last time. And the fallout is greater. Mm. That's an imagery that I think is important. So we have a situation where, if again, to give the example of the United States, the financial sector in the United States, the value of the financial sector is 350% of the national income today. It used to be, back in the 70s, it used to be 100%, which, yeah, in my view, is still too much. But it's 350%. Now, if, and in Britain, it's over 300%. Even in China now, it's over 200%. So what this means is this fictitious sector, which is primarily speculative, you know, making money by shifting money and so on, and short-term gains and so on, is subject to the whims of sentiment, herd reaction. So at the moment, they're all in a state of panic, sell. So the value of the stock exchange goes down by 20% in a week, or even more in some cases. What that means is that the financial wealth of a large proportion of Aussies and Germans and whatever has suddenly taken a hit of 20%. 20%, right? So that will have what we call a wealth effect. It will lead to people spending less, keeping their money, don't spend, which will make the recession into a depression because it's a demand shock. That's the case. And meanwhile, the indebtedness of those people I was talking about earlier will explode in their faces. They won't be able to service their debts. So we're going to have a surge of bankruptcies, a surge of homelessness, a surge of all the negatives that we talked about earlier. So we're on a complete edge, right? And this time I just feel that one or more sensible governments will set the example, and once they set that example, you will see a different type of herd, a herd of it following. Once people realize, I sometimes think that Jacinda in New Zealand could do it. I know Grant, her finance minister, and he has told me a number of times that he believes in a basic income. He believes in a basic income. Well, Grant, here's your chance. Do it. And you know, I was advisor to John McDonnell, the shadow chancellor of the Exchequer in Britain. Unfortunately, because Brexit, they never had a chance of winning. But he 100% believes in it. And he asked me to prepare a report how to introduce it into Britain. Okay? So we produced this report. And I think one of... just suddenly a government's going to be elected or be converted to it. And once one does it, I think you'll see a lot of others suddenly say, well, I want to do it. I want to do it. You know? So I'm more optimistic than probably should be the case, because there's a lot of negative out there. We still have the prospect, if Trump got re-elected, and a lot of things could go wrong this year with the tragedy that's unfolding. Huge number of people losing their lives, losing their loved ones, losing their family connectivities. It's the immediate shock is something that's dwarfing longer term considerations. But I believe a basic income is a necessity now for this resilience argument. And that's the point on which I'd like to end.
Yeah, Guy, well, I really appreciate your time today. It's been an exhilarating conversation with you, and it really has put a whole bunch of things together in a very powerful way. And thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.